Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
Welcome to Mafia, a new podcast telling stories of America's criminal underworld.
Gotti assumed the position of head of the Gambino family.
And using the name Donnie Brasco, I was able to infiltrate the Bonanno crime family in New York City.
Bugsy Siegel is an American mob legend.
One man changed the whole texture and landscape of crime in America.
Listen to Mafia every Wednesday on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your favorite shows.
Johnny Carson once interviewed Betty Davis and asked if she had any advice for young starlets wanting to get ahead in Hollywood. She suggested take Fountain. Fountain Avenue runs parallel to Santa Monica and Sunset Boulevards in Hollywood and is often used to avoid the heavier traffic. And isn't that what we're all after? A smooth run, no holdups, not only in traffic, but also in life. How do people handle those holdups, the rejections? How do they create a life in the entertainment capital of the world? How do they identify and express their uniqueness in a place where hundreds of thousands are hoping to do the same? Welcome to Take Fountain. Compelling stories from passionate people who've made it, are making it, in Hollywood. Writers, comedians, actors, filmmakers. I'll talk to anyone with a story to tell.
Welcome to Take Fountain, a podcast of passionate people working on their dreams. Compelling stories from Hollywood. Your host, Ella James.
Jose Arroyo, our guest today, is a writer and cartoonist, currently a staff writer for Conan on TBS. His cartoons have appeared in the prestigious New Yorker magazine. As well as Conan, he's written for Dennis Miller, Bill Maher. He's been nominated for 11 Primetime Emmy Awards for Outstanding Writing and has won twice. We met a couple of weeks ago when I was cast in one of his sketches called Eterna Kitty 2.0. So you should get onto YouTube. We'll probably include a link somewhere for you to catch that so that you can see his brilliance in action. Welcome, Jose.
Thank you, Ella. Thanks
so much for making the time.
Of course, of course.
I saw you've been nominated for 11 Emmys and you've won twice. So what's it like winning?
Winning is a thrill because you are named with your peers in the business, and these are the people from other talk shows, variety shows who've also been nominated, and they're all power hitters. So when, I don't know, when your bingo ball comes up and it's you that wins, it's thrilling. It's thrilling. The first time happened actually the first year I got on a staff. So that was what you would call my rookie season, where I got a job. I was nominated among my coworkers for an Emmy and then won the Emmy all in my first year.
And then it was all downhill magical. From there.
But a gentle downhill. Yes, exactly.
Well, you know, that's one of the things that I want to ask you. So it's great to be nominated and it's great to win. But what happens on those 9 other times where you're nominated and you don't win?
It's far easier to pretend to be humble than to pretend to be gracious.
Right.
So it's almost always more fun to win than it is to have to say, hey, good job, Daily Show, which of course won many, many times in the past. So, but that's just the way it is sometimes. And the true consolation is they called your name. Yeah. You were listed among the ones who were considered for the award. So whether you win or not, and this may be rationalizing, it feels great. You were invited to the party.
Yeah. So I want to talk to you about the resilience that you've developed through doing this. But first of all, let's get a little bit of a snapshot. Where did you grow up?
I grew up mostly in upstate New York. So I was the son of a professor at Cornell University, one of 7 children that he had, and I was the second in line. And I developed an interest in comedy just because hearing an early Woody Allen album on a cassette, of all things, just flooded my brain with endorphins, made me laugh even though I didn't get half the jokes.
How old were you?
I was like 10.
Really?
11, yes. This is something, however old you are in fifth grade.
Yeah.
My fifth grade teacher had a Woody Allen album on cassette, and he played a little bit, and then he let me take it home, and I listened to it, and I had to ask my mother what an orgasm was. and she claimed she didn't know, and then she said it's an attack of nerves. That's what I remember. So I go, all right,
Has that impacted the rest of your life?
Yes.
Yes, oh my God. How did that then play out? As a teenager, you know, did you do stuff at school that was involving?
To get attention, I loved to get to be the wisecracky guy. I wasn't going to get any athletic awards. I had a facility with language, and maybe it was growing up bilingual. You know, we spoke Spanish in the home and English in school, and
right. So
I was always pretty good. I mean, at 12 or whatever, you're doing a lot of puns, you're doing a lot of wordplay and things like that.
Pre-dad jokes.
Exactly.
Right. We'll
exactly.
get to those.
Yes. So we. So, and then of course you have a lot of, I grew up one of seven kids, so you have a lot of people to try material off of, you know, try to get your brothers to laugh.
Yeah.
And so it kind of built from there. What I found was that I was really drawn to the happiness of comedy, the response, the pleasure you get out of making someone else laugh. And and then around college, I noticed that there were opportunities to do stand-up, so I cobbled together 5 or 10 minutes of jokes. They were, again, pun-heavy, but it was a start.
Do you like being on stage?
Not as much as I used to. I felt that when I started, it was a guaranteed outlet for my humor. I didn't have to wait to apply for a job. I didn't have to wait for anybody to give me permission. If there was an open mic night, I could just put my name on the list and go on stage, and then the audience would decide if I was funny. But I didn't have to wait for a producer, I didn't have to wait for a writer to send me a script, that kind of thing. So it was liberating in that way. And I don't do it as much because I feel like my inner ham has been satisfied in other ways. Maybe by drawing and self-publishing these comic books, I get to have my name on something. It gets to be my thing, but I don't have to, wait 4 hours outside a comedy club and sort of do that whole thing.
It's funny because somebody said to me with regard to improv, when I arrived here, I studied at UCB, and
great.
They said,
"That's great.
You've got to work out whether you're going to do improv or whether you're going to be a stand-up because you can't do both." And their argument was that improv is all about team playing,
yes.
And stand-up is all about, you know, traveling solo. It's totally up to you what you do.
Yes.
I don't agree with them because
yes.
I think you can do both. It depends
yes.
on the person, but they very clearly identified what the necessary skills were.
Exactly. Yeah. And it's, I'm yes-anding. I'm agreeing with you
yes.
as an improv person. but you are right. The best... There are people who can do both very, very well. There's a guy named Rick Overton who you put in an improv situation will slay you, and is also a great stand-up comic. But in general, I would say that they kind of exercise two different muscles, and one is far more cooperative. You are in a team environment. The goal, I guess, of an improv is to... It may be different. It may not be about laughs per minute, or you're certainly in a different dynamic with other people
yeah.
than you are solo. And that's actually what got me out of stand-up comedy eventually, was that I couldn't see... I got bored with my material before my audience did. but I got bored with it, and I had trouble realizing that it's new to them. So I would start doing it in a very rote way. And I think if you talk to veteran stand-up comics who have an established act, they say that sometimes they're thinking about what they're going to have for dinner later in the middle of their strongest bit, they've done it so many times, it's become rote. Whereas in improv, if you're doing it right, you have to be very, very present. Your mind can't really wander as much. So again, two different muscles and two yeah. different things. They both deliver laughs. I would actually give the edge to stand up, although they can both be sublime and they can both be dreadful.
I did both a couple of weeks ago, and I totally agree with you. I saw an interview with Peter O'Toole on YouTube this morning, and he was being interviewed about his acting career, which of course was stellar.
Of course.
And on the subject of learning lines, he got on to talk about these Russian theatre companies from the late 1800s. And for years and years and years, they performed the same play over and over and over. He said Marlon Brando did Streetcar for maybe thousands of performances yes. before it ever got to film. And because the interviewer had said, oh, you know, how you have to learn your lines. And he said, no, you have to study your lines. You don't understand. And that's the thing. Delivering the lines as freshly as if they had just come to you. So the difference is, to me, that in acting, as in improv, you're listening. So you're not waiting for a gap to deliver your next line. You're listening to the other person's line, which then allows you to deliver your line as freshly as if you just thought of it.
Exactly.
Whereas
exactly.
comedy, there's no one there, right?
Right?
And there is nothing worse, and I don't know if this has ever happened to you, where you tell your killer line and the audience is filing their nails.
Yes, yes.
They didn't hear it, they didn't get it. Sometimes it's my Australian accent that queers the pitch, right?
That's
and
right.
I'm like, okay, I'm gonna repeat that for you with my American accent, so you'll understand what I'm saying.
That's right. get everybody in the fold that way.
That's
yes,
right,
yes,
bring him in. So you went to college, what did you study?
I started out as a pre-med, and then I was rapidly failing, and Cornell said, you know, you should take a leave of absence to get your head straight and figure out what you really want to do. And I told the administrator, I don't really feel I need a leave of absence. And he said, I really he told it to me in no uncertain terms that they were going to tell me to take a leave of absence unless I chose to take one. So I went and washed dishes. This is, you can't make it. I went to wash dishes at a seminary in Washington, D.C. while I went and tried to do stand-up in my 6 months off of college. So in the daytime, I was in a seminary surrounded by some nice affectionate men. And I'll say that because I was given some attention. And then at night I would go out and do stand up. So that was my days and nights. But it made me appreciate the comfort and of the college experience because I didn't live in a very good neighborhood in Washington, D.C., and my roommate got mugged, and life became a little more real, and I got sort of scared back into or told, you know what, you have other options. Focus on your studies, figure out what you really love to do, and then go back to Cornell with a different mindset. So when I went back, I changed majors from pre-med to creative writing. And that was what I could do that I was being pulled toward instead of feeling like I was obligated to do it was a more organic desire to write creatively.
You said then, and I responded to your facial expression, and I have to apologize, that you were receiving some attention from these.
Well, it's a podcast, but I have to tell your listeners, I used to look a lot better than I do now. And yes, I did receive some attention at the seminary.
That must have been frightening.
No, it wasn't frightening. It was, I was not frightened.
Okay.
I was in such a different world than this suburban upstate New York place. I was now in a city. I was pretty much on my own,
yeah.
and And it was
what
just
were you,
one
like 20?
I was 20, 20, I think.
Wow,
I was 20.
Okay.
So I was chopping onions in the kitchen, and every now and then, a gentleman who I, just started paying attention to me.
Right.
a seminarian, so
yes.
He was not much older than I was.
Right.
But it's funny, I'm just telling you this for the first time. I don't think I've ever mentioned this before, so.
Yeah, well, thank you for sharing that. You see, this is, as much as we talk about this, is about the journey and the dream and all the rest of it. I'm very eager to find out what leads people forward. And I do believe that sadness and pain and challenges provide a blueprint, if you like, or they allow us some kind of growth.
Yes.
That allow us to find something important. They become so uncomfortable, they're like a stone in your shoe.
You eventually
have to stop and take the shoe off. And you're forced to move to a position that is going to be better for you ultimately.
Yes.
And
yes.
This, of course, is what you're saying happened. So you were able to change your major. After 6 months, you went back to Cornell.
Yes, and I had a totally different outlook on education and on my future. I felt burdened by being a pre-med major, which I had no business doing.
So funny, looking at you now, I'm like, that would be such a funny doctor, right? That would be just funny,
yes.
Like, you know, it's not become an OBGYN.
No, exactly. yes, I found my sort of truer calling, how about that? Because I was interested in medicine, but my truer calling was something in the creative arts, and that was the writing. And after I graduated, I felt a tremendous amount of pressure to get a career job, to do something with a liberal arts major, either teaching. What else are you gonna do?
Yeah, yeah.
I clung to the idea that I could do stand-up comedy or do something comedy-related.
And did you know what that might be? Had you ever...
No, and it was a burden because every holiday I would come back to the house and I would get... I have five brothers and one sister. By the time I was coming back for holidays, they were all either graduated from college, or they had jobs, they had stable sort of certain careers, and... They would tease. They would just say, "All right, if anybody buys a house, make sure it has a room for Jose, in case it doesn't work out for him."
They were all busy adulting.
They were all busy adulting. Exactly. So, I'm still waiting for that. I'm still waiting to be an adult.
Yeah, when I grow up.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah, right. Oh, I totally hear you. You're standing outside Cornell. You've got your certificate. You're wearing your mortarboard, and you're like, "Right, I've graduated."
So,
and then
I go down back to Washington, D.C. because I was afraid of New York City. It loomed so large in my imagination as the crucible where you'll be either crushed or you'll be refined into gold. It's the place where people make it or don't make it. Mm-hmm. That I thought, well, let me get my chops up to speed in a different city and then at least not come into New York City as a rank amateur. And I did. I basically stayed for 2 years after graduation. I stayed in Washington, D.C. I met my fiance there. We moved together to New York City, and I began to hit the clubs. And I began to try my material at a place called The Improv and Stand Up New York and these places. The Improv is closed, but Stand Up New York is still there. And... one of the early highlights was being told by Silver Friedman, who ran the Improv at the time, "You're good, we want you to come back here and work out." Now, by that, what they mean is we want you to show up and wait for a spot to be available for you to do your 5 minutes, and you may have to wait till 2 a.m. to do your spot for four people. And that was... again, the hard road, the dues paying part.
Oh, you're
of
telling
it.
Me. I've done that.
Yes.
I've done that, and I had one person in the audience, and they had consumed so much liquor that their head was lolling. Yeah. And then in the middle of my set, they just put their head up and screamed an obscenity. Yeah. And you know, said I was pretty and then fell asleep again.
Adorable. Oh, my gosh.
But that's what it is.
Yes, and right? He was probably waiting to go up after you.
Yeah, well, so, yeah.
You don't know.
I just think you crawled in from somewhere, but yeah. But it's what you, this is, and then you've got to get up in the morning, and so you get to sleep at 4, and then you've got to get up at 7.
At a work
because
time.
You've got work, or you've got an audition, or you've got to write, or, you know, so it's a huge thing. So you kept working
I
the
I did
clubs.
That. I would take day job. I would take temp jobs. So that I would not get attached to anything for too long, so that I could call my own shots or call my own outs if I had an audition, or if I had to do stand up or something. Because I'm very mindful of if you're going to give your time to somebody, you're giving your time to them. So I said I'm just going to stay at entry level jobs where I can easily be replaced. I don't need a lot of money,
yeah.
And I'll just be free to do
what
my
are you
art.
Talking? You've got a fiance who's moved to New York with you, and you've got six siblings with
true.
Houses and
this
spare
is
rooms.
True. There was a lot of
there
outside
pressure. There was a bit
pressure.
Of pressure, right?
A little pressure, for sure, for sure. But it's always great if they give up hope, because if they give up hope on you, then you're free.
Right.
And I felt like I was the bohemian, the artist, he's just following his own path. Yeah. And if you have 7 children, one of them can be that black sheep, and it was me at that time.
Right.
So I was tolerated, and I loved and everything. But in terms of like my personal needs, you know, we ate a lot of spaghetti, and that was just what you do. And it doesn't matter if you're doing it for what you love anyway. So
yes.
You'll do anything.
What was the first big break?
The first big break. Was discovering that Jay Leno had a fax line that you could submit material to him and he would do it on The Tonight Show. The reason this was, I no longer exist.
I'm
the
going
Tonight
to support
Show.
The audio of this to give you a description of my visual where my jaw just hit the desk.
Yes, they'll okay. Get a gif of a whole jaw falling. It was well known in the stand-up community, and when I discovered that, I tried to find a way to get permission, because you needed permission from NBC or from the people at The Tonight Show to be a submitter. I was temping for a guy, and I said, I don't have an agent, I don't know how I can get permission for this. And he said, I'll be your agent. He typed up some letterhead, he faxed it to The Tonight Show. I got back a very formal legal thing that said anything you send to Jay Leno becomes property of The Tonight Show, and we will pay you $50 if we use a joke on the air. And so his audacity, what do you want to call it?
His support?
His support.
Was he an agent at all, though?
Like absolutely not. He was a very proactive guy who was very, I think he understood that what was standing between me and my dream was a formality.
Yeah.
But he took a risk or a dare that I would never have done. Like, I would never dream of doing that.
Yeah.
But I owe him the start of whatever else I became to that little leap, that moment of audacity. And
that's extraordinary.
Yes, yes, yes.
One question I ask everybody.
So long story short, I start submitting material to Jay Leno. I start submitting material to Jay Leno, and the first batch he uses a joke that I wrote, which
the first batch
in the first batch it was a generic as hell joke about the 4th of July, how there's something like explosions and colors and screaming, and that's just Dad trying to light the grill. It was that lame of a. But anyway, it got on, and I got a $50 check, and I thought, okay, my stand-up is entry level. I was a decent opening act.
Right.
But this is validation from a stranger, and he used a thing on national TV that I wrote.
Yeah.
So that just, you're saying, but in terms of a breakthrough for my ego and for my sense of that I was in the right job or doing
the right
thing.
Oh, I've got shivers just...
That was it.
I totally get that. Do you still have the $50?
No, I think that was... I should have kept the check. Right. I might have the check stub, believe it or not. But that's just because I'm a hoarder.
Yeah.
But yeah, I could have that. $50 didn't come frequently enough to make it a paying career.
Yeah.
But it started me writing topical monologue jokes every single week that the Tonight Show was on. So if it was a rerun, I would do them, but I wouldn't send them anywhere. But every day I wrote, and that was my gym, my workout.
Yep. During that time, after you submit your first batch and you get a yes.
Yes.
And then after that, you're submitting week after week.
Day after week,
day. Day after day after day.
Right. And nothing.
Nothing for how long?
For probably 7 months.
Okay,
until I heard another joke, but yes.
So you're watching the show. They don't tell you they're going to use your joke?
No,
you've just got to watch it?
So I watched it. I don't know. I don't think I had even a VCR at the time, but I was watching it every night to see if I heard the setup to my joke.
Yeah.
And then I would be like, because, these are topical jokes. So let's say President Clinton was in the news and he had just visited the ambassador of Mexico. If I wrote a joke about President Clinton visiting the ambassador of Mexico, then I knew that I had a shot at, if the joke is mine,
right,
this could be it. So, and sometimes it was, most times it wasn't. But that was my little gambling or my little game at night, every night. If I heard a premise that I had written a joke for, is it $50? Is it,
yeah.
Or not?
It's like, the money on the box, the money on the box.
Exactly.
It's like, will I win?
Exactly.
Well, so the feeling, I want you to take yourself back, and this is difficult because we see things, we paint a much brighter picture of the past.
Yes.
And we make it almost romantic.
That's a defense mechanism.
Of course.
I think, yeah.
But I want you to go back to a night in your apartment where you've been watching the show every night, and it's maybe 2, 3, 4, or 5 months down the track. How did you cope with that non-acceptance, which
yes.
is in fact rejection? Okay.
Yes, of course, it is rejection. Well, one of the things that I consoled myself with was if he did a joke on a topic that I had submitted material for, sometimes I would say to myself, my joke was better. He didn't use my joke, but I thought I had a better angle on that idea, or I had a better twist, or something more clever to say about it.
Yeah.
And so that was, maybe that was just me trying to consult, sour grapes.
Yeah,
I was
yeah.
like, oh, well, he didn't use the best one.
Mm-hmm.
And other times I would submit, you submit what comes out that day, and you have your good days of joke writing and you have your bad days. So there are days when I thought, okay, well, there was nothing in my batch that was similar or equal to what was aired. You struck out, you go back to the bench. But that was it. I mean, on a day-to-day basis, I never let it crush me because I had other, while I was submitting to Leno, I had other outlets for my comedy, either through stand-up or through a sketch comedy show that I later joined.
Yes.
So I had other venues. And that's another thing. I don't know who the target audience of this is. But
people. It's people. All people.
People. Okay. So
we call them people.
I won't bark. I'll just address people. It's good to have more than one channel. For your art or for your creativity, so you're not, your ego is not tied to one outcome or to one thing.
That's very supportive of polyamory.
Yeah,
don't just tie yourself
exactly
to one partner.
To one
have
person.
Multiples. If one lets you down, just moving right along.
Yes, exactly.
One of the questions that I do ask people is, I know myself when I decided to come to Los Angeles, to America, I wrote down a list of pros and cons, and I wrote down a list of all of the events of my life that I regarded to be important, good or bad. And I discovered that there was a person attached to every one of them, that it wasn't necessarily what I had done, although I needed to have a level of skill or I needed to be in the right place, but it was ultimately down to a person. So who was
that
a person? I love your story about this man who was not
sure
an agent. having the insight to offer you that support,
yes,
so that you could get ahead. Have you found that that's the case as you've moved along?
I think so. I think certainly if you look back on your career, there are people all along the way who just gave you a boost or gave you or brought your name up in to someone of influence or authority, and that can make the difference. And that's your break, really, is to be in somebody else's radar and be remembered well in that person's radar, or remembered competently, and that's what you can bring to it. So if they see you in a stand-up showcase, they can say, "Oh, you know, I saw Ella doing this thing. She was great.
Yep.
Why don't we consider her?" Mm. But yes, throughout, I think I've had moments where people have been my booster.
Yeah,
they've reached out and promoted me. Yes.
Yes.
Exactly,
yes.
Exactly.
So you're in New York, and you've had 7 months of sending jokes in on a daily basis to Jay Leno.
Yes.
And
That actually turned into 2 years, I think, of sending jokes to Jay. I didn't stay in New York. My wife at the time was a professor, and she would take these 1 year fellowships. So I would follow her around the country. And the way I would earn my keep at the time, because I was going to different cities with her as she went from college to college to teach, was by writing teen novels under an assumed name. So that was the way I would bring in
income. Can you tell me the name?
Well, it was a series. It's a defunct series called 18 Pine Street, and it was a writer for hire thing. So I would get a couple $1,000s to write these. These teen novels under the name Stacy Johnson. And the thinking by my publisher at the time was, men don't write, you know, teen novels. It's mostly women, so we have to give you a female pseudonym.
And oh, this is this is George Eliot in reverse.
Yes, exactly,
right?
Exactly.
This is,
or Evelyn Waugh in ahead. Yes, but either way, I think I did that for 3 years, where I was ghostwriting or, you know, secretly writing teen novels. And
what's your preferred method of writing? Do you write by hand, or do you type? Or?
I have done everything. I collect typewriters, so I have a fascination with the clickety clack of an actual manual typewriter. But I realized that it's whatever is at hand. Don't get bogged down by the device. It's really, for, you know, you're trying to convey something that's inside you. Use any means necessary. So as you can look at, as you can see from my office, I have papers all over the place, handwritten. I have sketches, and then I have stuff, you know, files and files on my computer. It doesn't matter as long as you get it out.
I heard another interview that you did where you said that. In these writers' meetings where you're all waiting to pitch a joke, that you sketch.
Sometimes, yes. During the meetings, I find someone who's not looking at me, and I draw their profile, or I draw their a fellow writer. And if I'm not disgusted with the outcome of it, I usually post it on the wall.
Oh, that's so cool.
Yeah. So.
The other thing, and I might have this wrong, was something about somebody telling you she had written a book. And it's about drawing ever-increasing circles on a page.
Yes, Linda Barry.
Right.
In one of her books, talks about breaking through periods of writer's block, or in her case, maybe create a creative block for how to work on things by this sort of meditative spiral. And I don't know if it's just to give your monkey mind something to focus on and letting your subconscious work on the problem. But yeah, she talked about drawing ever widening spirals.
Oh no, I love that. I think
yes, I don't.
I think that's great. I mean, anything
yes.
that can get you out of that that funk, because writing isn't writing. Writing is editing.
True. True.
So I find. And I'm not really a writer, but I have to write some of the stuff that I do, whether it's for my blog or for this or for my comedy. I have to just get it out on the page first,
yes.
and then I come back to it. And it can be minutes, hours, days, months, years before I come back to it.
Yes, yes.
And invariably, There's always something that can be reworked in some way, shape or form.
Yes.
So important to get it down rather than throw it out and think, because I self-censor. I'm
true.
Like, do you do that? Like, oh, that's not good enough, or no, I can't do that, or...
Yes, I think every good writer has a draft file of stuff that didn't meet their own standards, and it's healthy. Otherwise, you're just emitting, you're vomiting, you know, and that's without editing or without sort of reworking something, it gets a little self-indulgent.
Yeah.
So we, as readers and as people and as adults, have acquired some standards for what we either find funny or good writing. And it's logical to try to rise to those standards that most people have. I tend toward perfectionism, so I keep things a little too long sometimes. Mm-hmm. But that's a flaw. You actually have to find that balance between...
You have to liberate the words.
A little bit.
Liberate. Yes, let them out of your heart.
Exactly,
yeah, right?
Exactly.
It's hard. You almost need to become a different person. And so you will appreciate this story. A friend of mine gave me some comedy that he'd written the other day. Uh-huh. And he said that he'd shown it to somebody very close to him and that they had said, "Darling, no, this isn't funny." And I said, "You must never show anything to your partner unless they are a writer or a comedian or, you know, so that they can offer something." Because it's very usual for somebody, you know, I used to sing for my aunt and I'd say, "What do you think?" And, you know, she'd say, "Well, you know, you're not really Celine Dion, are you?" So they're comparing you to people who are really
good at
that. At
the peak of their careers.
Right.
Who are getting paid millions in Vegas. That's a harsh comparison to someone who's really trying to entertain you.
Well, but you must never, like, do you show anything? When is the first time you'll show something to someone?
That's in a job where you're trying to come up with comedy for that night, you can't be too precious.
Yeah.
You have to get it to the level where you're not horrifically ashamed, where it's grammatically clear, and then you send it in to be thumbs up or thumbs down by the group, by the writing group at mm-hmm. Conan. So you can't be too precious, you hone everything as long as it takes to get to that level where you're not ashamed or you're not embarrassed, and where you know that you're not taking advantage of someone's kindness to read your first draft, to read your first efforts, which, you know, many writers, Nabokov said, right, you know, the first drafts are sputum, and Hemingway said first drafts are shit, you know, they are. Stephen King said, you know, write your first one with the door closed, your second draft with the door open. In other words, the first one's for yourself, and the second one is to show the world. But fix it, you know, between the first and the second. So, again, here I can't be too precious. Then with a personal project, I've had an essay I wanted to submit to The New Yorker for 2 years, and it's been in the, quote, workshop, you know, tinkering and, oh, I gotta get back to that. But with no deadline and with something that's completely personal to me, I can wallow in it and it's never, you know, and it may never go out. But that's not good. If you wanna be successful, you have to risk, you have to put it out.
That's the beauty of writing, isn't it? Like, if I left me for 2 years, I would put on and gain 10 pounds and lose 15
right.
And then get wrinkles. But writing just stays in the drawer, right?
Yes, exactly.
Just stays on the hard drive.
It can, if you, yeah. But if you're serious about either being a comedy writer or a performer, at some point you have to get out of your room. You have to get out of, or you have to send stuff out to the internet, which is this, you know, great venue now. Or if you're a performer, put stuff up on YouTube. You can't wait.
Yeah. So you've been with Conan for how long now?
Since 2002. So I joined him when he had a show in New York City called Late Night with Conan O'Brien. And I was coming off of a show here in California, an HBO show. And then I moved my family to New York City to start with Late Night. And I felt like I was thrown in the deep end, but I prevailed, and I was very happy to be working for. I've been lucky. I've kind of worked for people with Bill Maher, Dennis Miller, and Conan people, I think I'm pretty smart, but they're really smart. So I'm kind of, I think I would chafe if I didn't respect the people that I was working for.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's good to, it was, when I found Conan and he seemed to like what I was doing, I guess I thought, to this very day, why would I look for something else? Why would I go anywhere else?
Right.
So it's
14 years.
14 years,
you're,
I know.
You're almost adulting together,
I know. I'm 14. Well, 14 is the time you start rebelling, so maybe I should be on the lookout.
No, do it in dog
changes.
Years. It's do it in negative dog years.
Negative
so divided
dog years.
By anyway. So tell me about an average day. What do you do?
Well, an average day starts with looking online for newsworthy things that we can make fun of. Conan isn't the Daily Show, he's not the Nightly Show, so he doesn't feel an obligation to report on the latest political thing or serious international incidents in that way, even with a humorous bent, the way the Daily Show did so well, the way that Colbert did so well. But we do find trends in the culture, fads, less politically volatile mm-hmm. things, and we joke about those.
At this point, here's a commercial for Eternakitty 2.0.
Exactly. So we take the idea that some women like the company of cats, and we combine it with the idea that some like cats but wish they could also have a guy to mate with, and we combine it into this man-cat animal that you'll see on Eternakitty. So, that's that.
So you go online, you see the trends, you look, and you do this on your own? Do you do this at home, or do you do this in the office?
The writers on Conan each have a computer, we all have internet, and we all have our own offices, and we come up with news items to pitch jokes about or pitch stories about,
mm-hmm.
and then we have a 10:30 or so meeting in the morning, and the ideas come out to the arena where 10
this is
writers.
Like gladiator.
A little bit.
Open the gate.
it's gladiator, but I sincerely believe that it's everyone's hoping for the best idea to win. It's not I want to put my idea, no matter how flawed, up on in front of Conan.
Yeah.
Because here's what happens: you pitch your ideas at 10:30. Hopefully, the best ones get picked, and they're developed into either a parody commercial, a sketch, a series of graphics or something. So they have to be sent to other departments to be given their sort of their full life,
yeah.
And then they have to stand naked in front of Conan at rehearsal at one in the afternoon, and then he will thumbs up or thumbs down the idea. So he has to go out of the writer's room with hope in its heart, and then be created, and then Conan can decide whether or not it's going to be worthy to go on the show that night. So it's exhilarating, and then it can be either exciting because it got in, or he calls it the souffle falling.
Right.
The souffle fell. What can be done?
Yeah.
It didn't quite have the spark.
Right.
And so you want to put them out there with the best material, and sometimes your thing has spark and sometimes it doesn't. That's just, you do so much every day that's just the law of averages.
Right, right.
So, and that's why we have writing staffs, so that the onus of coming up with brilliant stuff isn't on one or two gifted people. It's a democracy. It's somebody, we say, we may have the hot hand today, and I might have it tomorrow, or I may have a cold spell for 4 days, but everybody has to contribute, and sometimes it's somebody else's sketch or time to shine. And Conan has a staff so that he's never out there with nothing.
Yeah, but you're not only a writer from the perspective of writing comedy. I mean, you have a visual and oral approach to it as well. You, when you create it, you're creating a vision as well.
Yes, I've always loved drawing. And back in college, I was failing math. And at Cornell said, look, We gave you the remedial math class, and somehow...
And you're 25.
We're either going to give you a graduation or a job. They said, you can take an art class instead of math, and it'll sort of fulfill the same requirements for the degree. And I was delighted. So I went from failing at math to going to this art class, this drawing class, that again lit up a lobe in my brain that has lit up every time I draw. It's just something that I discovered that I delighted in.
Yeah.
But it's even more than comedy. It's something that you say, well, how dare you even try to put your comic books or your drawings out into the world? Everybody has some ability to draw. Everybody draws as a kid. I felt like I had no right to...
Really?
Oh, absolutely.
Really?
No,
you must be
right.
Really hard on yourself. Right? Where does that come from? Does that come from anywhere? Does it come from inside you? Is it something that happened?
I think it's a mix. I think everybody is... I don't know if there's one thing. My father was a very high achiever. And I think, I aspired to be a high achiever. I may have had an I'll show them feeling when the brothers were teasing me about not having, still temping at 27.
Were number two. So.
And I was number two. So the older one, he was almost like a third parent. Very responsible, and then I was the jester. Mm. And then others sort of found other niches.
Adults.
They were adults. Oh, yes. They're in business, they're in management,
right.
They're teaching, they work for colleges, libraries, and so on. They're all very integrated members of society. So I don't know. I just felt that I wanted to achieve something at my level, in my field of interest, and with my love of comedy, that would maybe allow me to hold my head up at the family reunions.
Right.
So I didn't take any career defining jobs. I stayed loose so that I could follow my dream.
Yeah.
And
look
that
at you now. Dreams are funny things because I don't believe in goals.
Uh-huh.
Okay, I think they're God's comedy.
Okay.
Because the closer you get to one, it morphs into the next level.
Exactly.
And you never actually get the chance to pat yourself on the back or congratulate yourself or feel that you have a sense of achievement. Do you find that?
This is true. There are some outside imposed finish lines in Hollywood, the Oscars, the Grammys, the Emmys. These are finish lines for something. But the person who attends these award shows is 99% of the time is no longer doing that project. So if they win, even on TV, if you win for something, well, that was for an episode you did 8 months ago. What are you doing now? But they are, those finish lines are the award shows or things like that that tell the outside world, hey, we appreciate what you did. But I'm pretty sure the artist who's picking up that Oscar is thinking, okay, what's my next thing?
Brie Larson flew out the day after the Academy Awards to get back on set. You know, she made three trips from the other side of the world for those promotional interviews that they have to do during award season.
Yes.
And then she was bang, she was out of there. So totally, totally get that.
Exactly. No permanent... finish lines, of course, except the cosmic permanent finish line. But until you reach that one, it's a process. It's an evolution. Mm. So you go from project to project.
So in a world that measures itself on projects, completion, levels, and awards, how do you... I may have said awards twice then.
That's
I have
okay.
them on the brain. How do you... check in with yourself and feel your own success?
I'm a little bit allergic to patting myself on the back. I tend to accept when I'm doing a podcast. But I tend not to fixate on the lows or the highs too much. So I one thing that sort of keeps me sane or level-headed is that there's another show tomorrow, and I've got to turn something in at 10:30 for it. So you can either spend too much time bemoaning your failures or patting yourself on the back for your successes. And that cuts off the edges of the extremes of your career a little bit. And you have to focus on today and tomorrow and the next day, which really, I mean, without getting all zen on it, is
you're
maybe
gonna get
the
zen
way.
If you like.
But it's the snail's way. I don't know what you would call the booklet, but it's the way that you'll make it, is just, again, with diligently looking at what's the next thing, the next step, and keeping it small. Of course, we all have higher goals that we want to reach, but it's very mundane and very, it's all about like persistence. It's about getting up in the morning and putting on your best face and going to that audition, or confronting a rough draft or a blank page and saying, all right, without getting too hard on myself, without hating myself, let's see what comes out in this writing session.
Mm. Or I'll go and buy another typewriter.
Or I'll go and buy another typewriter.
How many do you have?
I have 100 typewriters. So
you must be popular at home.
I am, except on moving day, yes. Then they all weigh 500 pounds. I started collecting them. I really believe I like typewriters because I heard my father typing in his study at home, and that meant he was home, he was working. It was the sound of industry or of creativity or something, and it just latched on. And I do have a collection, but it's like having a car collection of Toyota Corollas. In other words, I just buy them because they're manual, not because they're expensive or rare or fine, none of that. There are people in our town who do collect those, like Tom Hanks.
Right.
But I'm not at that level, so.
That is such a beautiful story, though, that notion of the things that we hear in the home, and we know that everything's okay.
Of course,
right?
a cooking smell can take you back, a candle scent, anything like that.
Yeah.
Yes, it's true. It's
when
true.
You're a single woman, it's the flashing light on the answer phone. You know, it's like,
of course.
I don't mean to be tragic.
Not at all. That's a beautiful example.
The one of the things that I've noticed, anyone in the creative arts tends to have, and I'll be intrigued to know whether you do as well, tends to have these moments where they wish that they were something else. They'll use the word normal. They will wish that they could go somewhere for a job every day. It's like with their banana in their briefcase and turn up and then leave. And on the way home, excuse me, say, you know, I have to pick up some milk, and then this weekend we're going to do this, and you know, like it's all about the children and the family and so on. Whereas for artists, it's I had to cancel something because I had an audition on Saturday. Like, and people who aren't in the industry, are like, what do you mean you're working on Saturday? I don't stop working.
You don't.
And so do you stop ever?
I don't think so, and I think as a creative person, you are blessed and cursed with having a restlessness and a combined with a curiosity about what you can come up with. So that doesn't really shut off. It's not like, and in fact, that's why I took usually boring day jobs, is because I knew that I had this other outlet for my creativity at night when I was doing stand-up. And I actually feel sorry for people who don't have this restless creative urge. But it's hard to turn off. I mean, you do want to, especially if you still haven't made it to your definition of making it. Well, sure, then you're on the clock all the time. There's always something, another class you could be taking, another audition you could be going to. So, but even when you get to a certain level of security, then it's impelled, then it's coming from inside you. Well, how can I beat my best? How can I top the thing I did last week or last year? And that never stops. The other thing is, and again, this I say this with joy, is if you have trained your mind or if you've opened your mind to being creative, you get little presents throughout the day. Some turn of phrase that just comes in, and it can come in at 9 p.m. It could come in when you're driving home, and I got to remember that and write it down. So you never turn, you don't turn it off. It just sort of gives you little sparkles. You can't rely on them. That's why we have offices and work hours and so on. But
what stimulates you?
What stimulates me? It's hard to know how to answer that.
Music, nature, books,
I see.
Television.
I love cartoons and visual comedy. When I was growing up, I read Peanuts. I identified with this humorous comic that had a sad boy as the center of it. So it was a kind of combination. Somehow it was funny or endearing, and yet this kid, you know, in panel after panel, I'm so depressed. So it was an odd thing. And later on, Calvin and Hobbes, these are cartoons. They're immediate. They're just little pellets of happiness. They're brief. Spend an afternoon flipping through a book of them, or just get them daily if it's something in a newspaper or online. Yeah, visual art is excites me more than most things. I feel like I have stunted my growth musically. I am stuck in the 90s or 2000s at the latest. That's an admission of of just the way my mind is geared. I like sad songs from the 70s. Dance songs from the 80s.
It's really easy to be sad about songs from the 70s at the moment, because they're all dying.
They're all dying.
Right?
What a run this year has had.
I know, this is crazy.
Yes, right? And I had just seen the Eagles documentary on Netflix, and then Glenn Frey goes, and but yes, thank you for the music, everyone. Thank you for the music. You will not be forgotten in my car. I will sing you forever. What stimulates me, I would say it's wanting to do a good job here with topical news, cartoons and cartooning and drawing, and then I say music third, although I am in awe of music. I respect music very much. I'm just...
Do you play anything?
Very poorly, absolutely.
You have a triangle?
I have a...
No! Tell us what this is.
This is a ukulele, and when I say I play it poorly, I'm not exaggerating. So,
come on, can you give us a little something?
Sure. Raindrops keep falling on my head, and just like the guy whose feet are too big for his bed. Do it again. Let's do it again. Sorry. Okay, I think that's enough torture
that's
for your,
so,
for your
that's
listeners.
So cool.
Sorry, I do not see a delete button on that machine.
No, there isn't one, and it's mine. Stand
good
back.
God. All right.
Now, so you raised something before, and I can't remember the context of it, but it was something I wanted to ask you about anyway. And that
let's ask the court stenographer. Can you just read back the last 20 minutes,
right,
please?
Yeah, that's right. Clack, clack, clack.
All right.
That notion of, and look, can I apologize? I should have turned my phone off.
Oh.
And the reason
I'm... Has it
been
buzzing or something? I don't even know.
It is buzzing. I'm just going to turn it off because I'll tell you something funny, and you might be able to use this, but I've been getting calls from a facility in Texas from an inmate.
Oh, no.
Who would like to chat with me.
Oh, my gosh.
So I get that voiceover recording from, like, on serial, You know, this is a collect call from
the Texas Penitentiary.
That's, yes.
Why don't you take my calls, Ella?
People keep saying to me I should take the call, but I'm too scared.
That's an interesting situation. I don't know. How did they... first of all, very often...
That porno prisoners, that I did, clearly.
Clearly.
That's a joke.
Sometimes call centers are actually run in prisons in the United States. So a lot of these... call centers are operated by inmates, and so it's possible that your number was part of a list and that they were actually doing some mass callings and yours stuck out.
Anyway, that's my exciting life.
That's very exciting. Actually, not at all. I think that's very
exciting. I think we can do something with it. So we'll have it. I'll give it to you after this. I've kept the recording because I thought somebody should do something.
That's funny. Well, we had a coworker here who also got some unintended attention from a prisoner was a diehard fan of this individual I won't name, but started sending them fantasy fiction about how they could hook up and included some line drawings, which as a cartoonist I found amateurish at best. But anyway,
There's a certain naive style,
exactly.
You said something a little earlier, and I can't quite remember the context of what it was, but it was along the lines of, and when you reach your success, whatever that may be for you.
Yes.
So... what is success for you today?
That's good. It used to be on David Letterman's show as a stand-up. And when I realized that I didn't want to do stand-up anymore, it morphed into just getting a steady paying gig as a staff writer. That happened in 1998. That was my first staff writing job on a TV show. And so that was one level of making it. And then because you've reached that level, now it has to be something else. I can look back and say, I'm providing for my family. We have a mortgage, I have a beautiful daughter, and this is all thanks to my ability to do my job. So the question was, how do I define making it?
Yeah.
Now it's being able to continue to produce material for the show, and also to have something extra or additional to work on, because right now I give my material to Conan, and it's filtered through Conan's sensibility, the TV show's sensibility. But there are other facets, we want to say, there are other facets of me that would like to be expressed, and so I take to cartooning or to drawing or things like that. Mm. So as long as I have a day job and a side job or a side interest that is also creative, I think I would define that as success.
And to always be doing something.
To always have something in the hopper.
Right.
I think I've mentioned this before. I don't want to be caught by the Grim Reaper with an empty table. I want him to come up to me and say, "Oh, you look like you're busy," and then take off. You know
what he sounds like?
Yeah, that's exactly what he sounds like. That was smokers.
So you mentioned your cartooning, your comic books. I've read one of them, Seething with Joy, Volume 1, and I just
thank
loved it.
You so much.
It's so gorgeous.
Thank you. Yes, I started drawing comics. And submitting them to The New Yorker back in 2007 when the Writers Guild went on strike. So I found myself with some free time, and I had always wanted to submit cartoons to The New Yorker. And I got to a certain level, I thought, of my drawing that I could go there, at least, if not with my head held high, with my head held level. And I turned them over to the editor at the time, and... he took them and he said, he looked over the drawings and said, "We have a lot of artists here who work in a naive style, but yours isn't good enough to be called that." And it was devastating. But then he quickly said, "But your comedy is good and I'd like to see more of your stuff." So that was being batted down and then raised up. And then I started making a pest of myself over at the New Yorker cartoon day. And eventually, two of my cartoons made it in. And that was the validation I needed to say, okay, well, I may not be the best artist, but I didn't devote myself, my life to becoming the best artist. I devoted my life to being a humorist. So if the jokes are good enough, he'll buy the cartoon. Yeah. And then that's what made me decide that if I can do that for every now and then for the New Yorker, I can also do it for myself with ideas that don't fit the show, that don't fit the New Yorker, that are just outlets for my opinions or my axes to grind or my political thoughts or whatever, or my whimsy, you know? I have a cartoon called Emergency Garnishes, you know, these things that you can toss into a plate at the last minute, like dice, you know. It's just silly stuff. So it's an outlet for what doesn't fit on the show.
Can you please do one called My Whimsy by Jose Arroyo?
My Whimsy.
Because it's just kind of cute. Emergency Garnishes is excellent.
Yes, thank you. You could, you could put a fan your keys on a plate. You could a tangle of earbuds. All these things can work as side garnishes on your plate.
And a tangle of earbuds, I totally get.
Right? I'll have a burger.
There's no way. You can wrap those things up,
yes.
And no matter where you put them,
no.
As gently as you put them,
exactly.
It's like Medusa when
yes,
you get them out again.
It just coils itself into an... yes.
I love the way you see life.
Thank you
for your time. It's just been joyful.
Thank you so much.
I'm not seething with joy. So your comics... they're available online?
They are. On Comixology.com has a digital version of Seething with Joy Volume 2, and that's where you can look for my comics. There are some panels that I've done that I've featured on my media page of Twitter. So go to @SeethingWithJoy and look in the media, and you can scroll down. You'll find some of my comic panels there, too.
Perfect. Jose Arroyo, thank you so much for your time.
It was a pleasure. Thanks for doing this.
Yeah.
Thank you. See you on Fountain.
You've been listening to Take Fountain with Ella James. For more, like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter. You can subscribe to the podcast at Audio Boom, Stitcher, iTunes, or your favorite podcasting app. This has been another quality podcast production from Bytes.com.
Welcome to Mafia, a new podcast telling stories of America's criminal underworld.
Gotti assumed the position of head of the Gambino family.
And using the name Donnie Brasco, I was able to infiltrate the Bonanno crime family in New York City.
Bugsy Siegel is an American mob legend.
One man changed the whole texture and landscape of crime in America.
Listen to Mafia every Wednesday on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your favorite shows.